Consider the difference between these real news headlines from about a week ago. This one is from NBC News. Trump claims he lost popular vote because millions voted illegally. That last part, millions voted illegally, is in quotes because there was no evidence that the claim was true. The Washington Post's headline provides a little more context and analysis. That headline is Donald Trump's bogus claim that millions of people voted illegally for Hillary Clinton. This discrepancy between a headline that repeats an unsubstantiated claim and a headline that calls out the lack of evidence is something media critic Jay Rosen has been writing about for years. And he says it's an even more crucial distinction as we head into 4 years of a Trump presidency. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, some local thinkers will join Jay Rosen, who's in New York, in a conversation about challenges journalists are facing today. Later in the show, artist Roger Shimomura will join us to talk about stereotypes and memories from an internment camp during World War II. For now, Jay Rosen, good morning.
Good morning.
Explain the distinction between evidence-driven journalism and allegation-based journalism, which you write about extensively.
Well, allegation-based journalism means that if someone makes a charge, you say it and print it, and that is the news. And evidence-based journalism, the first question before you report something is there anything to this? Is this true? Do we have evidence that will confirm it? And the difference is in what makes the news.
You documented in your recent article a back and forth between you and a journalist at USA Today. Could you recap that back and forth for our listeners?
Sure. This is a news story. Host, the billionaire who funds the car.
Oh, you know what? We're not getting a great connection, so we're going to bring you back on. Okay, Jay, let's start that over again.
Okay. The USA Today journalist wrote a story in which we learned that people on the right in U.S. politics were charging George Soros, the billionaire foundation person, with supporting the protests that erupted in cities around the country after Trump's victory. And it was reported as an accusation, people making the charge. And the news was people were making this charge. And there's actually no evidence at all that Soros is behind those protests. And that fact was mentioned in the story, but as a he said, she said. So that's accusation-driven journalism. If it was evidence-based journalism, the news would be people are making this charge without any evidence whatsoever.
And Jay, just to let you know, we've switched our mode of communication with you. We're with you by phone now. So it sounds like, you know, these two different versions of journalism, I mean, these two different approaches to headlines maybe represent two different philosophies about the role of the journalist. One is perhaps a mirror or echo chamber, and the other as more of a filter.
Yes, I think that's true. You could also say that one is more interested in advertising the innocence of the news organization, a sort of a hands-off approach where we don't take any role other than telling you what people are saying. And the other approach is much more aggressive in trying to sort out what's true from what's not.
So are you saying that you think that part of what's behind just repeating what people are saying is maybe a fear of taking a stand?
I think it's an attempt to elude criticism and to show that you're not interfering. And it's part of a culture of timidity at news organizations, sometimes like USA Today, sometimes like NPR, which I've also written about quite a bit.
So what do you think accounts for the culture of timidity?
Well, I think in NPR's case, it's the fact that there are still about 5 to 10% of the budget that comes from federal funding, and the belief is that you can't make people too angry on one side of the political spectrum because that might influence Republican votes in the Congress, and because the structure of NPR with its board and financing and just makes it vulnerable to political pressure in a way that commercial organizations sometimes are not, although they are vulnerable to pressures of other types. In USA Today's case, I'm not really sure. It might have something to do with the fact that their identity is the nation's newspaper, and they see themselves as providing news for everyone. And so listening to crazy charges originating from one corner of the internet may be a sort of misguided way of showing that you're listening.
That you're listening to all of the people who are out there and taking all points of view seriously. I mean, is that an aspect of allegation-driven journalism, that every point of view is taken seriously?
I think it might be, yeah. I mean, that might be the motivation here. But journalism exists to place us in a fact-based debate and to allow us to grasp the reality of what's going on in our country. Now, under that rule, the fact that people are making these sensational charges is news, but the news is that they're doing so without evidence, and that was the point that I was trying to make.
When it comes to headlines, we know that most people read news online in a scan and dive manner, which is to say they scan the headlines and then occasionally dive deeper as their interest might be piqued. So the headline itself can be the whole story for a vast swath of the public. Can you talk to me a little bit more about the headline issue in particular?
Well, I think people in journalism have, for a long time, kind of known among themselves that the headline can be a little bit racier and more sensational and more exaggerated and more extreme than the story. It's sort of a little trick we play on you, but if you read the story, you get a more accurate picture. And that sort of sleight of hand that became routine in newsrooms is now a more serious matter because sometimes all people see is the headline. The headline itself generates reactions and sharing online, and headlines are much more important as clickbait than they weren't once were. And so I think headlines now have to be seen as little pieces of journalism in themselves, and news organizations have to take much more responsibility for them.
You know, something that a friend of mine who is also a journalist encountered recently was that in the lead up to the presidential election, an article she wrote about the stereotyping of a certain demographic of voter was given a headline by an editor that had Trump's name in it, even though the article was only very indirectly about Trump. She was told that it was because it would get more clicks. Jay, I wonder, I mean, when you say that clickbait is part of how we ended up here, can you tease that out in a little more detail for us?
Well, sure. There's often a direct relationship between the number of people who click on your story and revenue, even though it's tiny, the amount of revenue per click, you know, fractions of a hundredth of a cent, they do add up. And more importantly, people in positions of responsibility in newsrooms are under pressure to meet certain goals, and once they discover, which is very easy to discover through the kinds of analytics or metrics they have in newsrooms, what words, what terms, what images, what stories, quote-unquote, work, the temptation to go in that direction is clear. And the cost in trust, in misunderstanding, and misinformation don't come back to the news organization directly, but the benefits do. So you can see how the incentive system might work.
Yeah, Jay, we only have a little more time with you. I realize that, but I want to bring in another voice and we'll get right back to you. Peggy Lowe is here with us, and she's KCUR's primary investigative reporter. Peggy, I want you to chime in on what Jay was just discussing. I mean, can you talk about how you navigate this territory with the obvious need for a headline to accurately represent what you've reported, juggling that with the obvious need for eyes to land on that headline online.
Right. Well, I have to say I agree with virtually everything Jay has just said. I also believe that this stenography sort of journalism of the past, the one he was arguing with the USA Today reporter on, is a thing of the past. I certainly hope that. I agree with him, too, on this cultural timidity that many places have. I came up through the ranks working at the wire service at AP and then newspapers and now in public radio. And I've certainly seen that, you know, everywhere. Not huge, not like a large serious problem, but there certainly is that. But the rules have changed. I mean, Trump is president-elect, and we have to check virtually everything that comes out of his mouth or certainly on his Twitter feed. And it's time to look at what he says and then report the facts as best we know them. Now, to your smaller point about the headlines, of course, we have to be very careful about that. At newspapers, you don't write your own headlines. Here in public radio, we do, at least locally. We don't when we have a story on NPR. So it is a little bit out of our hands, and yes, it has to be taken a lot more seriously. I would also suggest, and maybe Jay could come in on this too, the Washington Post has really had some fascinating headlines during this election season, and some of them are on opinion, but I feel like they've gone more Gawker Jezebel-y. For instance, Margaret Sullivan had a great piece the other day. She's like their ombudsman media columnist, and it reads, "The post-truth world of the Trump administration is scarier than you think." I mean, these are very bold headlines that are moving forward, at least at the Washington Post.
Yeah, Jay, please do comment on that, because I've seen that actually increasingly also in The New Yorker. And, you know, I read an article just last night on CNN Money, the CNN Money blog, that ended the final sentence. The first word of that sentence was, whatever. This was not an article about a snarky topic by any means. I mean, it was an article about the incoming administration. So I'm curious, Jay, what you think about a changing tone in mainstream journalism.
I think that's been happening for a long time. Part of the reason is that news now enters into a public conversation online in which many people are participating, not just professional journalists with copy editors looking over their shoulder. And with the rise of blogging first, in the early part of the 2000s, and then even more so with social media, journalists are aware that they are part of a conversation the public is having. And they have to talk a little bit more like the public does, because the days of news as the voice of God or coming from the mountaintop are decidedly over.
But do we need to be more authoritative? I mean, in this world where there is, A, so much information out there, just that you could be reading the news. You could do nothing but read the news all day and you would find material. I mean, and there's fake news out there we've been hearing about. I mean, how important is it maybe to reestablish that sense of authority?
Well, I think that's a good point. But authority, I think, will increasingly come from having your facts right, having done the work of reporting, like investigative reporting, and also being able to point to where you got your conclusions from in the don't believe me, look for yourself sort of way.
Show your work like in on a math test.
Yeah, show your work. And I think the combination of informal language in which it does seem more conversational, we're having a conversation with you like the best of public radio does, combined with strict accuracy, good sourcing, done the work, done the reporting, that's what's going to create authority, not this voice of the news that came from the 50s and 60s.
When you talk about allegations and the irresponsibility of letting them go unchecked, I think about the funhouse mirror cousin of the allegation, the opinion. What about, like, open forums aimed toward understanding each other better in a divisive time? Are they worthwhile, possibly more important than ever, or are they dangerous because they too circulate opinion rather than fact? I ask this. I mean, I host a talk show and callers and all kinds of people are invited to share their points of view. Is it my responsibility to deconstruct the logic of every argument made, or is it defensible to just let people speak if both sides are doing it equally?
I don't think you need to deconstruct people's logic, but I do think that when people come into a public forum and say things that are factually false as if they are true, that undermines the forum, because the whole premise of let's have different points of view is that they are different points of view upon a common set of facts. So when people believe things that are made up, that are politicized propaganda, that are fake news, we can't have a discussion with different points of view because we don't have the same facts. And I think journalists are entitled to stand up for a world of common facts, and they are entitled to say, I'm sorry, but what you just said never happened.
Jay, at the risk of sounding like I'm asking a ridiculous question, I do want to ask you what's at stake here.
Well, this is the darkest time for freedom of the press and serious journalism since World War I and massive censorship and propaganda before and during that war. Because it's not just that President Trump is hostile to journalism in many ways. It's that massive mistrust of the news media is out there. Rampant fake information and propaganda has dominated our public discourse in many ways. And there's an economic crisis in journalism, which you've probably visited one time or another on this program over the years. And journalists are under attack in many ways through not just what Trump says, but what his supporters believe. So this is an extremely dangerous and dark time if you think a free, vigorous, and serious press is central to American democracy.
Thank you, Jay Rosen, for that uplifting final word.
Sorry, I don't have better news.
No obligation to pretend the news is good. Thanks so much.
Bye for now.
Peggy Lowe, can you talk to me about pressures that make the kind of reporting and clear articulation of what's true and what's not perhaps especially challenging right now?
Mm-hmm. Well, Jay just, I think, referred to part of the overall problem, which has been the free fall in print. You know, in newspapers, it's newsgroups are shrinking. It's something like the numbers are something like at half of what they were in 1990. And so certainly there's just a lot fewer bodies having to do a lot more work. That's just the basic on the ground issues. But certainly, too, it's when you are doing a daily and a daily story or a spot news, as we call them in radio, and you have to turn it in an hour or so. And not only turn that story for, say, radio, but you have to write a blog post and you have to write the headlines and you got to get a photo. And there's just, you know, there's just so much more work to do these days in media than there ever was before. That it's really hard to be checking out all those facts. That said, we still have an obligation to do so.
So can you talk to us about a time when you clearly demonstrated that a claim a source made was untrue, and talk to me about how you reported that story in a way that gave you confidence in the assertion.
The most recent one, I would think, is I was covering the Missouri Senate race between Roy Blunt and Kander. And Roy Blunt was here in this studio with Steve Kraske, and they talked, I want to say, about 45 minutes. And Kraske asked Roy Blunt about a situation some years ago, I want to say about 2003, when Blunt tried to insert in a bill a provision that would basically help the tobacco industry. And the woman he was dating at the time, who became his second wife, was a tobacco lobbyist. It looked so bad, members of his own party had him, you know, remove that. And the Washington Post wrote about it. And everyone treated it as the truth then, including Roy Blunt. And Roy Blunt sat here in this chair and said to Steve Kraske, never happened, never happened, and really denied it all. Steve, I guess, couldn't, you know, while he was sitting here saying, I think you're lying. But we got off the air on that. And then I did a daily that day. I did a spot that said Blunt denies that it happened, but in fact it did. You know, I basically called him out for the truth on it. So it takes a while. I would suggest that some people in my newsroom probably thought I was you know, doing minutia and inside baseball, but I still thought it was important, so we did it.
Stay with me, Peggy. When KCUR Central Standard returns, we'll hear from a political science professor and a journalism scholar to find out whether this is something our culture has wrestled with before or if we're truly in uncharted territory. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. We are back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This morning on KCUR's Central Standard, we're teasing out the importance of citing evidence, not allegations in headlines. We've been hearing from KCUR's Peggy Lowe. Hi again, Peggy.
Hey, good morning, Gina.
I want to bring in our other guests now. We've got Max Skidmore and Pam Fine. Max is a political science professor at UMKC. Hi, Max.
Good morning, Gina.
And Pam is a journalism professor from KU. Welcome to the show, Pam.
Thank you.
So, we've been hearing a lot of phrases that I want to talk about. One is that the basis of shared facts in journalism, and another is culture of timidity. But before we get into those phrases, Max, how would you say that we got into this he said she said style of headline? Is it new or is it something? Is it something that has evolved?
It is definitely something that's evolved. It is new in the sense it's qualitatively vastly more than it once was, but it goes all the way back at least to the Nixon administration, in which his political hatchet man, then Vice President Spiro Agnew, was charged with condemning the press. And one of his alliterative phrases was nattering nabobs of negativism that William Safier allegedly coined and bragged about it dozens of times through the years. He must have liked it so much. But journalists, I think this phrase culture of timidity is perfectly suited for that. Journalists began to play it safe. They began to...
Safe from what?
Well, they began to play it safe regarding the charge that they were liberal. And today you see letters to the newspaper and so forth, and frequently they will. It's like damn Yankees used to be an additional damn Yankees syllable added to the word Yankee in the South. Liberal newspapers or liberal press is adding three syllables to the notion of a press. And the conventional wisdom finally has just absorbed the fact that the media are liberal, which is absurd. I mean, certainly there are liberal voices in the media, there are conservative voices, there are all kinds of things, but we live in a world permeated with ultra-right-wing talk radio, with Fox News, with Murdoch publications and so forth that are anything but liberal. And journalists have, I think, developed kind of a self-protective, not all of them by any means, but kind of a self-protective shell that permits them to criticize liberals. And soft pedal any criticism of conservatives because conservatives bite back. They're fierce fighters. And liberals, they're nasty people of any political persuasion, but liberals by and large tend to be civil. They tend to play by the rules of the game, and they think that civil discourse is what should characterize American political discussion. The conservatives don't agree with that. And I don't mean to paint with such a broad brush, but as a generalization, I think that's true. When Seymour Hersh heard from a Bush administration official, who clearly was Karl Rove, that, he was jibing at Hersh. He said, you reporters, you live in the reality-based world. That's passé. We create our own reality. There is no such thing. Just recently, even more than that, a young woman, I think her name was Scotty Hughes, a surrogate for Donald Trump, explained that there is no such thing as fact anymore.
Max, there was a commentary over the weekend on NPR by Alvin Noe who said that, you know, although the 2016 word of the year is apparently post-truth, she makes a case that post-truth has been around for a while, and she cites her own response to President Bill Clinton lying about his affair with an intern, that she knew that was true and didn't care. Do you think that then liberals are immune to post-truthiness, or is that is that an equal example?
I think no one is immune. I do think this is an example of false equivalency, because that has nothing to do with public policy. And as a matter of fact, if you parse Clinton's words, as Clinton was doing, he was speaking like a lawyer. They were defining they literally defined sex as sexual intercourse, which had not taken place. And as Monica Lewinsky herself was frustrated by the fact that it didn't, according to her own interview on whatever channel it was. But regardless of that, defending oneself on a personal matter that was humiliating and terribly embarrassing and completely inappropriate before the public with regard to your family and so forth is not the same thing as alleging that millions of voters voted fraudulently. Chris Kobach can make that allegation. Donald Trump can pick it up and cite Kobach as a source. Kobach then can say, look, this is correct because President-elect Donald Trump says so, and there we go.
Pam Fine, talk to me about this from the perspective of journalism scholarship. I mean, what do you think about this idea of a culture of timidity?
Well, I think it's true that the news media since, the early 1900s, trying to appeal to a mass audience and sell its product widely, has become less polemic and less political itself. But I want to be careful that we don't miss an opportunity to highlight the value of fairness and balance. Because what I agree with a lot of Jay Rosen's points, and props to him for elevating this issue, the idea that good journalism involves verification, involves evidence, it's iterative, and we work hard to find out things and tell readers the truth.
If I could add that I think it's not just has evidence, but leads with the evidence or lack thereof.
Agreed. But I also think that we have to be careful to not add bias to the discussion. And so I think the timidity, if there is some, among the professionals I've worked with and know, is the idea that we have to bend over backwards to make sure our understanding is valid and that we're not reacting knee-jerk to make a point that isn't there either. So I just want to make sure that we understand that what some people view as timidity is the journalist being concerned that he or she has good information to share.
And perhaps trying to keep their own bias in check.
Correct.
When you're trying to keep your own bias in check, are there like objective metrics you can use to be sure that you're not also just sort of spiraling into some kind of, overcompensation or warped logic? Because when you're not fully using all of the parts of your brain, just trusting your own judgment, what do you trust?
Well, I think you trust verification, that one of the most important skills is research. Another important skill is critical thinking. And those things combined help good journalists understand that they don't know everything, and they have to go out and find stakeholders and documents and information that gives them the depth and breadth they need to present to make sense, of issues and events.
So then is the fast turnaround a really critical problem? Because if you're having to turn around stories and headlines before you've had a chance to do that, how how do you do it?
Well, yes, it is an issue, but fortunately, with the age we live in, that fact-checking has been elevated. It's become all industry in journalism, and there's a lot better ability to get real-time information today than there ever was. And
that's interesting, though, because a lot of people have said, especially throughout the recent campaign, that fact-checking has diminished.
I don't agree with that. I think, in fact, two things have occurred in recent years. One is an elevation to provide factual information as quickly as possible on public policy and other statements. And the other is the rise in investigative reporting. We're seeing tremendous activity in new digital sites aimed at deep and substantial investigative reporting.
Peggy Lowe, what's your take on what you're hearing from Max and from Pam?
My take?
Yeah. Do you see this idea of like effort to combat bias in journalism and fast turnaround? I mean, are these issues that you deal with and that you have techniques for dealing with?
Well, we're never going to combat fast turnaround. It's just the nature of the business.
And especially now that politicians can tweet in the middle of the night and you're on the job again.
Right. Absolutely. I guess, I would say, like, to Pam's point about we need to be careful, you know, despite being criticized for the cultural timidity, we do need to be careful about what we're putting out there and making sure everything is factual. And quite frankly, that's just old school. You know, and there's been a couple of really good pieces lately about that. One was Jack Schaefer in Politico. He did a great piece last week called The New Rules for Covering Trump. For instance, number one is curb your Twitter enthusiasm. Like, you know, just don't react to all of these people. Keep looking at what you were looking at, whether that was the Trump Foundation or his conflicts of interest or whatever it was. Number two was starve the troll. You know, just don't react to the trolls that are chasing Trump, for instance. So I just think that, yeah, it is a new day. But as Pam says, let's adhere to the very basics of our profession and work very hard to continue to do that.
Pam and Max, I want you each to briefly give me your assessment of what you think is at stake, whether it be for journalism itself or for something as big as democracy, because journalism is called the fourth pillar of democracy. Max, I'll start with you.
Well, my study is of politics generally rather than journalism, but the two certainly are integrally related and entwined. And Jay was absolutely right, I think, when he says that editors and commentators and so forth should are entitled to a world of common fact. I would say not only entitled to stand up for that, but they are obligated to stand up for that. When they're faced with an egregious falsehood, they should correct it. Candy Crowley did that 4 years ago in the presidential debates. Chris Wallace this year in the presidential debate said, well, my job isn't to be a fact checker. And it's true that fact checking has increased considerably, in fact, immeasurably. But there are so many lies flying back and forth that people ignore what they hear.
Pam Fine, what's at stake?
Well, I think ultimately it's the ability to self-govern. I mean, what the purpose of the press is to give people information it can use to make decisions as civil participants. So the stakes are very high.
Pam Fine, Max Skidmore, and Peggy Lowe, thank you all so much. We'll keep asking these questions on KCUR's Central Standard. Up next, a talk with Roger Shimomura, an artist. His exhibit at the Belger called An American Knockoff explores stereotypes, a subject he knows a thing or two about. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. If you're visiting Lawrence, there are a few iconic places to check out. Allen Fieldhouse for a basketball game, after stopping by the Wheel for a drink, the Natural History Museum, Free State Brewery. But for international art scholars and art collectors, there's a much bigger draw: Roger Shimomura's studio. The artist has work in more than 90 museums nationwide, including the Metropolitan Museum of Art and the Smithsonian, so he's kind of a big deal. And he's here to talk about his current exhibit, now showing at the Belger Art Center in Kansas City. He's joining us on KCUR Central Standard. Hi, Roger.
Hi.
So this show, An American Knockoff, Tell me about it. What's the concept that, unifies this show and this body of work?
Well, it's one of three themes that I've worked on for just about my entire career that has to do with ethnic identity. The other two were about the incarceration camps during World War II and stereotypes from World War II. But this one has to do with some of the issues that Asian Americans, mostly Japanese Americans, have faced since the since World War II, and still goes on today, I think.
Can you talk a little more about it still going on today?
Well, you know, almost a week doesn't go by that I'm not asked where I'm from or, gee, you speak the language really well. The presumption that I'm a foreign, the presumption that if you're Asian, you must be foreign to this country.
You know, in your current body of work, the idea of whether you are a part of the scene that you portray or somehow separate from it is I think, a central question, because you paint yourself into scenes that are sort of chaotic with crowds often. And there are these iconic American characters in them, like Uncle Sam and Porky Pig. It's kind of like you're photobombing your own paintings. But are you doing that? Is your image appearing there as one of the crowd, someone who belongs in the crowd, or are you disrupting the scene? Do you know what I mean?
Well, I think what I'm really doing is struggling. First of all, I make myself into the various stereotype that I'm frequently identified by, that is a martial artist. You know, if you're Asian, you must know martial arts. And I use that role to struggle with Walt Disney, who created a lifetime of stereotypes of not just Asian people, but of all ethnic groups. I struggle with the Chinese people in trying to separate myself from them, because it seems like so many of the public people feel as though there's no difference between Chinese and Japanese, here, there's a whole history of struggles and wars between the two countries. And, you know, and I grew up with a little bit of that in Seattle as a youngster and a familiar. I went to a school that was very racially diverse. And so I'm very sensitized to a lot of the issues that went on between various groups of Asian and Asian American people. So the paintings puts me as sort of the hero figure in there that's trying to get things straightened out. But first of all, identifying those people that myself as an Asian American has had difficulties with in the past.
You know, you alluded to this earlier, but a lot of your work has depicted scenes from an internment camp, actually what I call an internment camp, but I've noticed that you call it an incarceration camp. Before we get into your work depicting those scenes, I'm curious about your terminology choice.
Well, there's been a lot of investigation into the power of words. And first of all, the struggle was it a concentration camp or not? And there was a lot of issues that arose as soon as the Japanese American community decided that they were concentration camps. One of the reasons being Franklin Roosevelt, who established those camps, himself referred to them as concentration camps. And also, by definition, internment camps is really a misnomer because it plays down the severity of it as being an incarceration camp. Internment was the term was mostly used for medical purposes, people that were isolated because they had a particular disease or medical issue, and so they were separated from the rest of the community. But it was primarily a way of softening what it actually was. I don't think the U.S. government wanted to be known or seen as one that put together concentration camps to incarcerate, you know, their own citizens.
You, I mean, you were in one of these camps when you were very young. How much do you remember from that experience?
Well, first of all, I've been very careful. If anything, I think my memories have become less and less because I've always been afraid of expanding upon the few memories that I do have, which primarily had to do with the severity of the weather conditions. I couldn't understand why leaving Seattle and moving to a desert in southern Idaho and what was a good option. All of the four seasons were so pronounced. It was the coldest I've ever been, the hottest I've ever been, the dirtiest from the dust and so on. And it was located on a lava bed. So you could imagine that, you know, physical circumstances of the camps were highly undesirable and very rough and raw. And that's primarily what I remember, although there are a few episodes such as getting measles in camp and being quarantined with my mother in a separate room, and we were quarantined for 2 to 3 weeks, and our food was passed through the slot in the door 3 times a day, and life was, I remember how incredibly boring it was because it was just the two of us in there. I can't imagine what my mother must have gone through during that period of time. But all of this is sort of cross-referenced by a diary that my grandmother kept, not just for the camp years, but for 56 years of her entire life in this country. She kept a diary, and a lot of my memories were corroborated by what she said in the diaries.
With those diaries and maybe conversations with your parents, I'm wondering what you know about the years and months leading up to that experience for your family. Was it do you know if it was a gradual process of ostracization or if things happened like quickly?
No, I think, it's hard to separate the kind of prejudice that they experienced prior to the war on whether, you know, there was any special type of prejudice towards being Asian. Of course, you know, they did have the Asian exclusion laws for quite a few years there. But, or whether it was similar to what all nationalities went through in one way or the other, you know, whether you were Italian or African-American or German-American or whatever. But certainly my grandfather, who was a cook at an Elks Club in 1907, talked about how when he would leave the restaurant late at night, there would be people standing there with rocks and would stone him. And so he finally had to leave through the back door and slip out by way of the alley in order to avoid being hurt. To say whether that was happening to all Asian Americans or whether it was just happening to some is a little difficult to say.
How did the time in the camp come to an end? It sounds like you probably don't remember it firsthand, but do you know about just how it all ended?
Well, when they finally decided that we were not a threat, and of course they had completely disrupted our lives at that point, since most of the 120,000 Japanese Americans that this involved had virtually given away or sold at ridiculously low prices everything that they owned, being as how they can only take with them to camp what they could carry. Most families, of course, have assets that are a lot larger, not to mention automobiles and houses and farms in particular, lost all of those things. And so after 2 to 3 years, when they gradually allowed the Japanese Americans to go back to their homes, they had nothing to go back to. And the climate, of course, was the political climate was very anti-Japanese. They were going to blame everything on them. And there were signs all over Seattle where we returned to, you know, that said, "Japs not welcome." go away, stay away, this is no longer your home, and things like that.
How did your family deal with that? I mean, as you've said, having let go of all of your belongings, having 3 years of your lives kind
of... Well, they handled it a lot differently than I think my generation, later probably learned a lot from the African-American protest movement. But the Japanese went about it trying to prove. I could cite one very clear example, I think, and that's when a couple of years after we got back to Seattle, we went down to Cannon Beach, Oregon, from Seattle for a one-week vacation. And we got down there, and it was my mother, father, and I was probably around 7 years old. And my father went in to register at this cabin. There were, I think, a series of seven or nine cabins. And then he came out after about 15 minutes and said the owner wouldn't rent to us because he didn't realize that we were Japanese. And my mom and dad sat outside of the car talking for the longest time. And then they both went back in and after about another 15 minutes came out and just quietly drove to where all the cabins were. And there's one cabin that was further back into the woods that apparently was no longer taken care of for years, was completely overgrown by weeds and was filthy because no one had used it in a long period of time. And my mom and dad went to the nearby grocery store, got cleaning equipment, came back and spent the entire day cleaning this cabin. And so we spent one day cleaning the cabin and then spent another 5 or 6 days trying to enjoy it. And we got back to Seattle after a week. And about the following week after that, my father received a letter from the owner of that resort saying that he would no longer put restrictions on who we would rent to and thank you for what you did and so on. And I think that that was kind of typical the way that Japanese Americans did things following the war and how they fought that racism. That's not to say that that was either the best way or the quickest way to resolve things, and certainly different than the way things happened after that.
What does it mean to you to paint about those experiences and to share those paintings with other Americans decades later? Americans who might not have been, most of them, alive when this was all happening.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, I've lectured when I was doing a series on, I call it my camp series. I went around the country lecturing at different museums, and when I went down to Jackson, Mississippi, no one believed me. No one believed that this happened because it wasn't in their history books. And there are parts of Texas, the same thing. And, of course, as I understand it, Texas is revising a lot of their textbooks. And one of the things that they're going to eliminate is any kind of education about the camps. So, we'll have generations coming from the state of Texas that's not going to know anything about this and how close this whole current day Muslim issue is to what the Japanese Americans went through. But depending on what part of the country you are, of course, in the West Coast, where it is in their history books, and a lot of people have connections to families that were directly involved in the evacuation, don't need the kind of education that people in other parts of the country do. So I don't think enough emphasis is placed upon the fact that a lot of this all depends upon where you live and the level of sophistication that you have concerning this issue.
Because you've got firsthand storytelling going on in a lot of parts of the country.
Yes.
Well, yes. Roger Shimomura, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
You're welcome.
Roger's painting exhibition, which originated in a Seattle gallery, is now on view at the Belger Arts Center. It'll be there until late January, and we'll have the information on that show on our website with this interview. That'll be at kcur.org/centralstandard. later today. Earlier in the show, we talked about evidence versus allegations in journalism and what's at stake for democracy. Keep talking about that on Twitter. We want to hear what you have to say. We're at KCUR. CST. Tomorrow, tune in for a chat with Patricia Lockwood. Last time we spoke, she'd been dubbed poetry's smut queen by the New York Times. Now she's got a memoir coming out. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Andrea Tudhope, Jen Chen, and Suzanne Hogan. Our interns are Aaron Pelish and Raven Brooks. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to date's next. Don't miss it.